It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host, and welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 70, The Best of Everything. I have three great panelists to discuss this movie from 1959, directed by Jean Nogalescu, and starring a lot of people, including Hope Lang, Stephen Boyd, Brian Ahern, and, oh yeah, somebody called Joan Crawford. Let's meet the panelists now, shall we? Beginning with Lisa Schmeiser. Lisa, hello, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for watching this movie, because it's one of my favorites to talk about.
Happy to do it. Nathan Alderman is also here. Hi.
I am very pleased to have seen this movie, though maybe not for the exact same reasons as Lisa.
Ooh, this is going to be fun. Also joining us is Randy Dotinga. Randy, hi.
Hi there. You know, I just got a message from Joan Crawford in the afterlife. And this is what she said. She said, "No more supporting actress parts ever."
Well, I appreciate Joan getting in touch because I don't get to talk to her very often from the afterlife. Randy, each time here on Lions, Towers, and Shields, I ask people whether they've seen this movie before or not. So have you, or did I inflict it on you, or by extension, did Lisa inflict it on you, whose idea it was that we watch this?
I have never heard of this movie, even though I'm a Joan Crawford aficionado. I mean, I figure at the very last days of my life, I will be in an assisted living home in Palm Springs, and my very last words will be, "Jorge, please turn on the Joan Crawford holocaust." Anyway, but I've never heard of this movie, and I just love this movie. It is just fun to watch, and it's incredibly well shot, and such a time capsule, such like this, as a combination of Mad Men and Sex and the City of its time. And well, I'm sure you know, Shelley, that this is like 65 years ago, and all men are not cads anymore. I mean, that's totally different now. Very few cads. It's like
we've made so much progress.
I think maybe 95% of men are cads now. So
but we have no Joan Crawfords either. So, you know, the world changes in many ways. This movie does come at the suggestion of one Lisa Schmeiser. So tell us why you wanted us to watch The Best of Everything.
Things just keep happening. To give you a little bit of an origin story, I stumbled on this movie for the first time when I was 23. I had gone to a departmental party in grad school, and all of us had cut loose after thinking big thinky thoughts about deconstructionists and French philosophers, as was all the rage in the academy at the time. And I couldn't get home. I was in no shape to go home. So I basically staggered sideways to another friend's house and was like, "I need to stay here until I am sober." And my friend's like, "Okay, fine." Turns on some TCM. We figure it'll be about 2 hours and then I can walk home. This movie had just started, and we watched in rapt fascination as development after development after development happened. And at one point, after one scene, which we'll talk about later, my friend was like, "Things just keep happening and nothing makes sense. I don't know where this is going." And it's a beautifully shot film. The costumes are gorgeous. The set decoration is gorgeous. Some of the acting is fantastic. And again, it's a hot mess of a movie. It's thematically jumbled and things just keep happening, but nothing ever makes sense. And I've had a soft spot for it. I watched it later sober, like a couple months later, and was like, "Oh, okay. Watching this drunk actually makes more sense." And I've had a soft spot for it ever since.
I feel the same way about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure because I watched it in about the same shape for the first time. But So Nathan, I know from previous conversations that this movie is new to you. What's your top line take on The Best of Everything?
Boy, is it new to me. imagine if they made a movie about women entering the workforce and the moral of the movie was women don't. I just watched She Said, which is the very good recent movie about the New York Times reporters and the women involved who took down Harvey Weinstein. And that seems appropriate, having seen this movie in which casual sexual assault is just a thing in the workplace.
Oh my God. It's so what makes this even more astonishing, Nathan, is the movie is based on Rona Jaffe's novel of the same name. It's a great novel. I encourage people to find it. Penguin reissued it a couple years ago. And there's actually a passage in the book that talks about how work gives the protagonist, Carolyn, a sense of purpose, a sense of structure, a sense of connection to something larger than herself. And it gives her a sense of self-esteem that she never gets from any of the men in her life. So one of the things that's just crazy, because before this podcast, I went back and reread the book. One of the things that's just crazy about this book is how this movie is how it basically takes the title and four of the characters and a few of the developments and still manages to completely miss like the point that the author was trying to make or any of the stories in the book or any of the resolutions. It's the ending of The Best of Everything as a movie is so far off the ending of the book, The Best of Everything, as to be
what
laughable.
What ending? What ending? The movie just runs out. It just stops like a parking meter. It expires. And that's it. It
comes out of a building. And,
well, no, yeah. You see, she takes off her hat, you see. It's her protective armor that she takes off. So she's fine. Mike, you were right. Thanks for waiting for me. We're simpatico. Okay. Where is in the book?
She does not throw it in the air a la Mary Tyler Moore, just to be clear.
No. Caroline's arc in the book is very, very different because at the beginning of the book, she walks into Fabian Publishing having already been jilted by her fiancé, who writes her and is like, I don't know how to explain this, but I've fallen in love with a girl who owns several oil wells. Wow, wonder why. And so when she walks into the office, she's unmoored. She has no idea where she belongs in the world. And she discovers that she's actually really good at publishing, which is how she quickly becomes a reader and then quickly becomes the youngest editor in the company. And over the course of this career, she and Mike have a very brief affair, and he's a total cad to her. So that goes away. And do you remember the really boring nice guy that like is so tone deaf as to insist on having the blind date with her while she has just gotten broken up with on the phone with the fiancé in the movie?
Who
that
could
guy?
Forget that ghoul?
Right? No, in the book, like, she's like, fine, I guess we'll date. And like, she keeps him on the back burner. And then, of course, the guy who ditches her comes back, proposes that she be his mistress. And he's like, you can quit your job and come live in Houston and I'll put you up in an apartment. And she's like, heck no, I like my job and I'm nobody's mistress. And I don't know why you think I don't have any self-respect other than the fact that I've been banging you for 3 days straight, but I do. And I'm staying here in New York. And at the end of the movie, she basically the end of the book, she gives him the finger by like running off for the weekend with a movie star. Like, it's great. And the whole point of that arc is that by the end of the book, Carolyn is this successful and ambitious woman who's learned how to protect herself from the predatory men in her life. And in the movie, it's like, oh my God, she almost turns into Amanda Farrow, but at the last minute, she takes off her hat. Like, it's
she
just
literally almost transforms into her. You can see them, like, it's
with
like
the
a
hair
slow
and the
transformation.
It's so great.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. It's not well handled. It's bad. That's bad direction. That's bad screenwriting. That's
and let's talk about it. So Amanda Farrow, for our listeners, Amanda Farrow is the single older lady, you know, late 40s, early 50s, editor who is just this glorious viper played by Joan Crawford, who is just like doing the full Crawford at this point. The eyebrows have second billing. It's amazing. And you meet her and she's just barking all these, contradictory orders. And she's super mad that this woman she's never met before, who's her temporary secretary for the day, doesn't know how to do anything. But over the course of the movie, as they become more collegial, Amanda's like, okay, you're not just one of the nitwits who comes in here until she gets married. You have a brain and you have ambition, so you're my peer. And they give her
after
this
initially being threatened by that.
They give her this embarrassing little monologue about how, oh, don't lose your capacity to love before it's too late. And Joan Crawford delivers this, and you can tell that, like, inside she is mentally counting the money that she's making, which is why she's doing this. But, her arc, of course, ends with her and the agreeable Letch being like, look, it's the two of us, we're the grown-ups in the office, let's just go have an affair over drinks. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of oddly endearing in a way. But Joan Crawford is great in this. And over the course of the movie, of course, Carolyn is trying to turn into Amanda Farrow, Joan Crawford. And part of me is like, you go, girl. Because, like, if you look at the other women on offer in this film, oh, all of those fates are dreadful.
Horrifying. Yes. But, yes. I mean, Joan Crawford literally has a monologue where she's basically like, well, I gave marriage a shot, but my uterus is calcified. So, you know, nothing for it but a lonely professional life for me.
Well, I actually thought she had a really interesting point where she's like having to switch modes from being a working, ambitious professional who had the luxury of just thinking about herself to somebody who was expected to put this man and his two kids first. She's like, I couldn't do it. I don't have the resources or the practice. And I thought it was kind of an interesting sideways way of saying that you kind of have to be socialized into this role while you're still young and pliable.
Randy, I think you had a question for us.
I haven't gotten an invitation yet, but when is the Lions, Towers, and Shields company picnic?
Oh, I hope we have someone with the ukulele playing.
Absolutely. We're going to have buses to take everyone there.
Label buses.
I saw that picnic and I was like, okay, now I understand why infidelity is such a thing if this is the alternative.
Oh, I mean, man. All of the parties in this movie are crazy.
So I love the bus scene for a couple really specific reasons. And the two really specific reasons. One, you can tell how Carolyn is already holding herself above the fray and separate from everybody because she's on the Amanda Farrow track. And two, April, bless her little bubble head, is like, isn't this simply marvelous? And you're like, oh, man, April. And three, Susie Parker, as Greg just passed out in the back, completely indifferent to anything that's going on and just going along for the ride anyway. It's like such a perfect moment of characterization. And just the ambient look, it's a gaggle of secretaries and they play the ukulele and they're idiotically excited about spending a day in the country. Oh, God, the whole thing is just this perfect encapsulation of the ethos of the movie.
It is the whitest thing I've seen since La La Land.
It is very white.
Wes Anderson is like, why didn't I think of a bus with a label on it?
The other parties in the movie are just sort of boisterous and drunken and ridiculous, and they happen in the office. But that one, that is, I kind of didn't see that one coming either. I saw the on the bus, and I'm just like, what is happening now? Where are they going?
What is happening now? Where are they going? Is pretty standard question, starting at about like a third of the way through the movie on to the end.
I tell you, this whole movie, the whole point of this movie is things keep happening and nothing makes sense. I love it so much. It's just...
All right, that's the title of the episode.
It was like Space Aliens wrote this with Google Translate. It's
Randy, this AI 55 hours of Madman plus it's a mad, mad, mad world. Let's see what it writes.
Now, Randy, I wanted to ask, did you catch the cameo by a major historical landmark in this movie?
Well, I did hear online that there was a palm tree at the company picnic.
In New York,
yes. Major historical, the Seagram's building? What do you mean?
No. So there's a scene where April and Carolyn are walking through the streets of Greenwich Village back to their little apartment.
Oh, Stonewall's in it, right?
Like, yes, the Stonewall Inn. I saw it and I was like, that can't be the Stonewall Inn. And I checked Google Street Maps and sure enough, it was.
Oh, I didn't. I read about it later, but I didn't notice it when they were walking around. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I paused the movie. I was like, whoa, that can't be that. It is.
I don't even know how long Stonewall was open. That would have been 10 years before the Stonewall events. So I don't know how long it had been open. That's super interesting. There's a lot of New York in this movie. There's a lot to look at. It's pretty. Both the scenery and the costumes and just the office decor, which is the most Mad Men thing I have ever seen in my entire life.
Oh, the offices are so beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah.
Except if you're going to shoot a movie in CinemaScope and Technicolor, why do you paint all the office walls gray?
because you're trying to show that the big city saps people of life, vitality, individuality. It's that whole man in the gray flannel suit. If you notice the opening sequence, it's this flow of women in dark suits, like gray suits, dark suits. There's a few white blouses here and there. And Hope Lang comes out and she's immaculately coiffed with her beautiful blonde hair. And she's got that crisp black suit with the white collar. And it implies that she's already got like a level of sophistication and professionalism that will have her fit in with that, right? So she goes in, and then the minute the secretary's hit, it's a riot of color and disarray and chattering. And that visual contrast and that behavior, that's very, very deliberate.
And the first thing we learn about her is that she went to Radcliffe, you know, mm-hmm. Vassar, Radcliffe, that sort of thing. So she's clearly somebody who's been educated beyond the job she's about to have. The first person she meets is this gossipy head of the typing pool who is very much her opposite number in terms of like personality and affect and all that, which is, mm-hmm. is terrific.
Oh, in the book, they taught that Mary Beth, they go into detail on how like she basically monopolizes the typing pool with all of the details of her trousseau, all of the details of her shower, all of the details of her wedding. And when they describe the wedding, that there's a really poignant passage about how this was the one day of her life where she got to be somebody who felt like she had accomplished something and somebody who was the center of attention, and she would hold this as the high point of her life for the rest of her life. And it's, again, unbearably poignant and also incredibly clear-eyed about the BS role that is, too. I can't emphasize that the book is just a gem, because Rona Jaffe is writing a book that's nothing like the movie. And it's, I suppose it's not surprising, but it's astonishing to see how far apart the book and the movie are, because the movie is, like Nathan has said, hey, ladies, don't get a job.
Yeah, the movie undercuts its characters and everything constantly. I mean, this is a movie where a character, there's literally a scene where a character is like, this guy sexually assaulted me. That is wrong. You guys should not be okay with this. And the movie's like, shouldn't.
She's a single mother. She's asking for it. She's desperate. She's a much bigger plot in the book. And basically the plot in the book is she does fine. She marries a dude at an ad agency. Everything is okay. They elope. I don't know why they bothered to include her in the movie. It feels like a lot was left on the cutting room floor with Barbara. Yeah.
Yeah, it actually does. And she's a well-known enough person and is billed high enough that I was like, wait, did I miss more of her? And no, she doesn't have a lot in the movie. And it's interesting because there's no way for a woman to win. A movie like this will sometimes say, what's the woman's path? The woman should be virginal and be married, or the woman should be this or should be that. But none of the paths that these women take, which differ from one another in small and large ways, end up where the movie would have a woman end up. A woman can't win in this movie. There's just no way.
Well, the only way to win is like become Amanda Farrow. You have to put your hair up because that's what all the fancy executive ladies do.
Definitely.
And get your own office and make more money. And then I guess eventually become, you know, old and shriveled up like Joan. And
but she's sad, right? We're supposed to believe that she's
unhappy. Because they imply, like, after that party, they're like, oh, good, I won't be alone. And then, boom, she's alone because Greg's run off with David Wilder Savage, the most ridiculous dramaturge working on Broadway.
Right.
But I keep thinking, man, her life slaps. Like, she's got an executive position. She gets to boss around a secretary and make them do the work all day. She's got this great New York apartment. She bosses around her secretary at the apartment. And when she decides that marriage and kids aren't working out, she rolls right back into her own life. What about that isn't aspirational? Why am I supposed to feel sorry for her?
I love her performance, too, because, Joan Crawford is Joan Crawford, but she doesn't. She's not chewing scenery. She is absolutely playing that character as that character should be played. And whether you think, oh, that's Joan Crawford or not, she is not doing it to excess. She's not, it's not showy in a way other than the way Amanda would be showy. I think it's just really well done. And she took this part because she needed the money. Her husband, who ran PepsiCo, had just died, and she needed the money, and so she took it. It was the first supporting role she had taken since Silent Film, which if you know that, and if you know enough about Joan Crawford, you're like, oh, well, you know, that's unfortunate that was the position she was in her life. But you don't watch the movie and go, oh, poor Joan Crawford. Whereas I kind of feel that way about Brian Ahern, who I never particularly like, but that's a very thankless part that he has as the company lech, who's sort of the Jones opposite number in terms of being the adult in the room, as you were saying earlier.
He's not a competent adult in the room. He is just, I loved him name dropping all of these writers who clearly left him in the dust back when he was young.
Right.
Like, everything about that character is there's that passage at the end where he and Joan Crawford are hanging out and she's like, oh, are you going to keep pinching the young girl's bottoms? And it's like, I'm really not attracted to their minds.
And she has that comment. Well, thank you for bringing up that you're married.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, everything about that. I love her in this movie so, so much. And the more I watch it, the more I'm like, she is the only one I really root for. Actually, I root for book Carolyn. I feel like movie awful. Carolyn has a really disappointing ending because she ends up with Stephen Boyd's terrible, smug, condescending Mike Rice. And I hate movie Mike. Ugh, movie Mike is the worst.
I also just don't think she's written as well as she could be. She has some good arc in the sense of she comes in, she's the, you know, the she begins as the typical new character. We're seeing the movie through her eyes and what is this place that she's just walked into? Mm-hmm. And she has things happen to her that aren't her fault, like her boyfriend decides to leave her and marry oil wells.
When did you first realize you were falling in love with the oil well heiress?
Exactly. Yeah. And you can see her ambition rising all along because she's got a college degree and this is what she's trained to do. She did intend to rise higher in the company, didn't want to be a secretary, and she's not really apologizing for that. But it's not written in such a way that gets enough sort of attention as to what methods she's doing it, because we're focused more on all the, you know, the soap opera aspects, which are totally fun. I really enjoy them, not for her character as much as I enjoy them for the other characters. And given what happens to the other characters, you would think that they would give Carolyn just a more straightforward arc of ambition and maybe having some second thoughts about whether she wants to end up with some of the bad things that have happened to Joan Crawford or whether she says, you know what, I do. That's the life I want.
Yeah, her arc is pretty straightforward. I would also like to praise Joan Crawford real quick because, yeah, there's a lot of camp in this movie. There is a lot of camp, and none of it is coming from Crawford. She is giving this ridiculous, insulting role a warmth and a humanity that it absolutely does not deserve. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you'd think that, you know, Carolyn's arc, as bad as it is, it's still an arc and it's still recognizable as something approximating reality, which you cannot say about April or Greg's arcs. They are just off in the stratosphere.
Let's walk through those arcs, in fact, and we can get back to Carolyn and to Hope Lang, and this will give us an opportunity to talk about the performances of the actors, actresses, and the actors, too. So we have Greg, who is played by Susie Parker. She is an actress, and she's working as a secretary to until she can not have to do that anymore, and is sort of taking time away from her job. But Joan Crawford knows that she's auditioning, and she's going to meet David Wilder Savage. Yes, that's a delightful name, played by Lou Jourdan. His name is David Wilder Savage, but he's played by Lou Jourdan. Whatever. and she basically freaks out. He breaks up with her and she freaks out and stalks him, and it does not end well for her.
You missed the part where she slowly transforms into a raccoon.
Oh, I forgot.
Oh, it's so sad when you see that beautiful trench coat get more and more smudged.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, they had dressing her in that because she was pregnant while they were filming. And so they had to keep covering up Susie Parker's pregnancy too. Again, I keep harping on the book, but in the book, it's explained that poor Greg had a really tumultuous upbringing and carries around like a complex about being abandoned. And so when David Wilder Savage does the full David Wilder Savage press on her, she feels loved and seen as an actress and accepted, and this is going to be forever. And then when he does the David Wilder Savage departure, that's finally what pushes her over the edge. So it's like a little bit more understandable than what happens in the movie, which is like, there's a moment on the bus where she's like, I need to call David. And you know, Carolyn's like, you just saw him an hour ago. She's like, I was an hour ago. I need to call David. And you're like, wait, what? But yeah, this whole, I reiterate, the first time I saw this and I was not entirely sober, I was like, Wait, did that just, how, why is she fixed up? Why is she picking up his laundry and going through his drawers and keeping his trash? What is happening? She's Susie Parker.
I had that exact same experience.
Does she know she's Susie Parker?
I had that exact same experience Stone Cold Sober. Like, why is she slowly transforming into a raccoon? The dark circles around the eyes, the love of digging through garbage cans.
Do you guys know that the Beatles actually sang a song about her? It was around Let It Be time, and there's a video of them singing a song about Susie Parker that's called Susie Parker, and I listened to like 30 seconds of it and had to turn it off because it was just basically them just saying Susie Parker.
that feels like Susie Parker's performance in this movie. I don't know if the movie is saying that Greg is supposed to be a bad actress, or if Susie Parker was at this point in her career also a bad actress, or both. But
yeah, she's a model. This is her second movie. In fact, the first movie she co-stars with Gary Cooper as his much younger love interest, and then she gets put into this. And apparently, yes, there were people who was like, she's not all that good. Why is she in this? And because she was beautiful and had some name recognition and such, I think that's part of, there was a lot of musical chairs casting. There were a lot of people who were cast and, in fact, were on set that didn't end up being in the movie. There were a lot of people like Joan Crawford, who was actually cast very late in the process, like after filming had started, and then she shows up, and a lot of her scenes were even cut. So I don't remember all the arc of how Susie Parker got in, but it was perceived to be some sort of coup for the movie to have her.
So there's a DVD commentary with Rona Jaffe, taped before she died in 2005, I think it was. And she talks about how in the movie theater, when Susie Parker shows up in the, I think it's in the coffee shop downstairs, and takes off her the covering of her hair, and you see all that red hair, the audience actually gasped because it's just so stunning. She is such a unique looking actress. I felt like she was popped in from a different movie somewhere. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, she's got a presence.
She pops in from Hitchcock, like, until she like opens her mouth. She does look like a Hitchcock heroine, doesn't she, with the scarf wrapped and the sunglasses and the gloves. It's a beautiful entrance. And it's the same thing on the bus where Carolyn has that level of sophistication that's above the chattering classes of the secretarial pool. And then Greg is just like on a completely different plane aesthetically from everybody else because she's played by Susie Parker, who was like the most beautiful model in the business at the time.
And it would have been so interesting had she been a better actress, because that part is a really good part. And for somebody who had more acting skill, she could have done a lot of interesting things with it. And yeah, I think she's supposed, well, it's clear she's supposed to be a bad actor because it's not just that David Savage rejects her on a personal level. Other people, somebody else, I think this is a good device. Somebody else says, she keeps going up on her lines. You got to fire her.
She's had to be rescued by children on stage.
Right. So it's clear that she's not up to the task.
Yeah.
But in terms of acting, you know, the part of the actor in this movie that Susie Parker plays, It's a really good part. I think that some of the ways there's a lot of show don't tell in the whole stalking scenes, which I guess is good. But you're right that there's no motivation. And knowing that about the book is kind of helpful because why did she go nuts? She hasn't even been dating them that long. There's a point, too, where I think it's apparent that after they break up, she hasn't told her roommates that they've broken up. Yeah. And I feel like that might have been a cut, too, where at some point they would have said, wait, Did you break up with David? No, we're still together. And which would have been just another, you know, odd bit of behavior.
Yeah. In the book, they find her trash hoard. And they're she doesn't tell them. In the book, she doesn't tell them. She pretends everything's okay. And April and Carolyn find the trash hoard and they realize everything is, in fact, not okay. And after that, Greg's plot development moves very quickly and ends very suddenly. Like it does. She ends in the book the same way she does in the movie.
As I wrote on Slack while watching the film, she's gone to be with the garbage cans she loved so much.
Oh, that's harsh.
Well, I hope ladies, I hope you're not wearing stilettos on Fire escape.
Fire escape.
Have you learned this?
Yeah,
lesson?
That's just the most ridiculous thing. Have we learned nothing?
Also, what is with her like picking up a kitten out of the trash? Okay, that's good. Fine, I'm on board. Cute kitten, adopt, save it, and then rubbing it against her face. Greg, you don't know where that kitten has been. Get it away from your face.
Well, she's lonely and she wants connection. She wants something to love her unconditionally. Like, this comes through again in the book. I feel like the movie is kind of as if it's as if someone read the book while holding boxing gloves and then began typing the script.
Strongman style.
It's unbelievable. Because in the book, the cat is kind of a through line where Greg brings it home. She has this need to tend something, mother something, have a reliable source of affection and attention. And by the end of the book, Carolyn's would-be lover comments on the cat and how adorable it is, and, you know, chucks it under the chin. And while she's still shaking him off, she's like, well, I guess I'm taking care of a cat now that Greg is gone. So it is also a metaphor for the burden of love as well as the need for unconditional affection.
We've thrown out the metaphor word. It's art, friends.
How did a woman get named Greg in the first place?
It feels like there must have been a sort of a story.
Like they wanted
the
a
book,
boy, or? And they're like, oh.
Yeah, right.
I am frantically Googling for the movie now, but there was another movie I watched around the same time where there was also another woman named with a very masculine name. And I'm wondering if it was just like a screenwriter convention at the time where they're like, oh, we'll signal that this woman is slightly iconoclastic, but not a scary beatnik. We'll give her the name of a man. And
because it's not something that comes, it's not particularly relevant to her arc or the plot or anything.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, let's talk about the other of the three roommates. Let's talk about April.
Poor April. No. No, April.
Sorry, we have to. Oh, April. Well, and her arc develops a little later in the movie because she doesn't. It's like all of a sudden she has a boyfriend. She didn't have one, and now she does. And he's a terrible, terrible person, played by Robert Evans, who will go on to become a major motion picture producer.
We should have known. Yeah. It's Robert Evans.
Rhonda Jaffe said that his casting was actually her idea because she's like, he just fits the part so
ironically. Yeah. Robert Evans,
who would be good at playing a cat? How about a cat?
Ironically, Robert Evans' whole deal in this movie is that the kid does not stay in the picture.
Oh my god!
Ooh,
nice. Well done. Oh my gosh! Well
done. I called April misforeshadowing. When I first watched the movie, because it's like, yeah, she just wanders in and instantly you're like, oh, nothing good is going to happen here. And then she might as well be saying, you know, my Uncle Chekhov had the most fascinating gun.
Well, it's funny because with the Greg character, I was forcibly reminded of Stage Door with Ginger Rogers and Katharine Hepburn, which is another story about an actress who ends her life tragically. Although in that movie, it happens early enough in the movie that other people, I don't know, learn stuff from it, take from it, deal with the situation, whatever. In any case, so now we have April and her Chekhov's whatever.
Chekhov's in any case, everything.
played by Diane Baker, who is still among the living. Mm-hmm. And I hesitate to point that out because I know Randy wants to blame me for anything that might harm that might come to her in the future.
Yeah, this is a situation that, you know, an actress, an old actress will die, and then we do an honorary podcast, and I'm like, this is very suspicious.
After the podcast, Shelley is carefully laying out her piano wire and her map with the route planned out.
Yes. Look out, Diane Baker.
Godspeed, Diane Baker. We don't want anything to happen to you. No.
Don't listen to her.
Protect your participation
yourself.
In Silence of the Lambs won't save you now, Diane Baker.
You were a delightful presence in this movie, Diane Baker, despite your war crime of a part. So please don't die.
Would you like to know how different her plot is in the book?
Oh, please.
Because it's,
yes, please.
It's the wildest part. So in the book, Diane comes, you know, she's Colorado. She comes from Colorado. She avidly studies under Carolyn's tutelage and goes from being, you know, fresh off the chorus truck or whatever the implication is, to another sleek, soigné, sophisticated New Yorker. In the book, she goes ahead with the abortion because she believes it will help her hold on to Dexter. It does not. In fact, Dexter recommends her to several of his friends. And there is a pretty raw chapter where it's detailed that she's effectively date raped by several of his friends. Like, he just keeps setting her up with his friends.
Yuck.
And she... Yeah, no. And well, the thing that I admire about Rona Jaffe putting this in the book is she points out that April, for all of her visual sophistication and the fact that she was able to pick up manners and attitudes from Carolyn, has no understanding of how the East Coast class system worked in the 1950s. So she didn't realize that if you're the type of girl who, you're never going to be the one who gets to go to the country club and get married. That's laid out really baldly and brutally over two chapters. What happens is a nice boy from back home comes on vacation. Their mothers set them up. He's not a doctor. He is, in fact, a real estate developer, a nascent real estate developer. He falls in love with who he thinks is a sophisticated New York woman. She falls in love with somebody who she's like, oh, he's not like all of the jerk stores who have been getting me drunk in assorted summer houses in Long Island for a year straight. And she leaves the city, and at the end of it, there's like a monologue about how she'd look back on this time in her life as being a time. It was kind of, oh, it's a golden time. She found out who she was as an adult. It was, but that time is over and she's ready to go be a wife and a mother back in Colorado. She's closing the door in New York City. And it makes so much sense in the book. It's just a great story arc. And it's one that's still pretty relatable because we all know people who like graduated from college, went to a big city, lived there until their 30s. And then were like, I would like some real estate, or live there. And we're like, I'm really tired of having, you know, insert urban inconvenience here, and then, you know, move someplace else. And they'll still talk about the things they enjoyed doing in the city. But that, like, it's really clear that that part of their life is over. Whereas in the movie, it's like a whole different thing.
What you're saying is that in the book, multiple protagonists can have full arcs that have beginnings, middles, and ends. Whereas in movies, oftentimes, the one person is the center of the movie and the other people just at some point fall by the wayside. You know, yeah. Happily Ever After is okay, but nothing more complicated than that is allowed to happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Was it okay ethically for that doctor to be like, well, just treated you for this miscarriage. Hey, you're hot stuff. How about we start dating?
He tends to meet a lot of laboring mothers. That might limit his dating pool.
At least in the 50s.
Yeah.
Back to Greg doing David's laundry, even though Ronnie, the doctor, who is not a creep, does bring his socks over to be darned, because apparently that part of dating someone is actually dealing with their clothing
and
in some
setting
regard.
Setting them up with drug samples. What was that about?
That too. What's up with that?
Weird.
That was weird. Like pouring out the drugs
on
the kitchen
table.
Who among us
hasn't talked about drug samples over the breakfast table?
Oh, indeed. Man. Yeah, I was indeed. Like, well, do you guys... I don't know if Nathan and Randy, you had the experience of reading a lot of Beverly Cleary growing up.
Some.
There was a book called Sister of the Bride that I remember finding in my library. It was like this ancient paperback, and it's clearly set in the same period as this movie. And like a boy that one of the girls likes actually brings over his clothes to be darned and sewed. And I can remember like looking up in my parents' 1980s den and being like, what the actual hell? Like, how is this remotely socially acceptable? Be like, oh, you have a few X chromosomes. I'm sure you know how to wield a needle. Like, it's just so weird how casually domestic, like the minute you see a dude and he turns out not to try to force you into an abortion by the side of the road in Central Park, you're like, oh, here, hand me your gummy holy socks, sir. This is love.
Well, I mean, but at least it is somewhat egalitarian that he is giving her free random drug samples in return for her labor.
That seems like a fair trade. And she gets to share the drug samples with her roomies as well. Or her
it's
roomie
too bad she's
left.
Not more
and
of entrepreneurial. She could pass those things out in the secretarial pool and make a fortune.
I mean, that office likes its substances. They'd probably take her up on it, I'm telling you. Yeah. They're half in the bag most of the time. Yeah. As I was saying before, like all of the parties, leaving aside the whole bus trip, every time they have a party, whether it's a wedding or whether it's an office party, that is a loud party. There is a lot of horsing around that is just like general chaos in addition to whatever sexual assaults might be happening.
And it's
just
genital chaos or general chaos.
Rambo.org.
right. Lots of callback. So yes. I wanted to say something interesting about the office pool. So in the Rhonda Jaffe in the commentary, she had one of these jobs as a very young woman. And then she interviewed something like 100 young women from New York before writing the book about their experiences in this kind of environment. And she said, which you see a little bit in the movie, she says the secretaries have to be there at 9 a.m. So they all come in at once. And then they sit down and they don't have to do anything for an hour because the executives don't come in until 10. So they sit there and they gossip and they get food and they get their coffee. That whole business with the coffee in the can that I didn't understand. and this is basically what their mornings were like. And the first scene in the office, I thought, I forgot about typewriter covers. I almost forgot about typewriters too, but the covers, I just remember them from like a zillion years ago, typing class, this little fussy cover you had to put over your typewriter.
Right. I remember those. But yeah, it becomes a nice thing for them to flourish. Like just so much, there's so much business in that office between the typewriters and the covers and all the things on their desk. And it's just
the one person whose job it is just to walk around with a little cardboard box full of coffee cups.
Right. Yeah.
And then there was, and if you look at the glass window and the front glass door, it has all the magazines listed. And one is just called Confess.
Oh, I should have stopped to read them. I saw that sign and I thought about reading it, but I didn't stop.
I paused. I can't remember now, but those titles, some of those titles are wild. One of them was like Teenage Monthly or something.
That's the one that Mike Rice runs, which makes it even creepier.
Oh, no.
Oh, dear. That's upsetting. Yes. That's very upsetting.
Like you watch him go into that door and it reads Editor Teenage Monthly. And I was like, why is this man equipped to deal with the thoughts and needs of teenage women?
Well, I mean, he is very much equipped to deal with the thoughts and needs of teenage boys. This is a patent leather drunk who staggers into the movie clearly hungover and is introduced checking out our heroine as she uses the water fountain wordlessly, as if she is a side of beef in the butcher shop window. Our hero, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is there any guy in this movie out of like, what, 8 or 10 guys that is even has any redeeming qualities at all? I mean, even the guy that Susie Parker sees before her demise, wasn't he trying to feel her up or get friendly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just trying to help you.
She was right to be scared of him. He was really creepy. And he was also just hyper. Like he was not doing anything to let me help you get in the door. It was like, oh, God. No, the only guy is Dr. Feelgood.
Dr. Feelgood is the only one. And even he's kind of creepy looking.
The dweeby little guy, the dweeby like teenage guy that Carolyn Bender runs into right at the beginning of the movie on her way into the office, he seems decent in that he does not insult or sexually harass or assault her. He just like
so. Of course, we never see him again.
Yeah, exactly.
They would have had to pay him more to do that. He didn't have enough lines.
And I think the guy that played Carolyn's ex.
Oh yeah.
He's another one. The guy,
Mr. Oilwell.
There were a few guys that just seemed to have no real personality, like no presence. And but anyway, he's still alive, so there's that. Yeah. Maybe he could date Diane Baker.
Can we talk about the magnificence of the clearly ADR dubbed in line when Caroline is breaking up with Mr. Oilwells, where she says, "I was wrong to try to break up your marriage," off screen when you can't see her mouth moving. That's some poochy level, I must go, my home planet needs me stuff right there.
That feels like standards and practices where, like, you need to point out that she has to feel sorry for what she did.
But he's the one trying to break up his marriage.
Oh, maybe that was it.
Yeah. But she has to pay for it. Yeah.
That's always the one.
Whereas, I keep going, whereas in the book, he proposes this, you need to quit your job and move to Houston and I'll keep you in an apartment and we can have one night a week. And she's like, no. And he said, but I love you. I love you more than anything I've loved in my life. And she's like, then divorce your wife. And he's like, I can't do that. And she said, so what do you love more than you love me, who you love more than anything in your life? And he can't say anything.
because he's unwilling to admit that he loves being comfortable. And she's like, right, I get it. And dumps him on the floor and goes out and like revenge bangs a movie star. And that's how the book ends. And it's great. So yeah, exactly.
Well, that's
fun. And like, she's heartbroken while she does it because she's like, I was a fool for this man. I can't believe I thought love actually worked, which is why, again, movie star who calls her and he's like, I will take you to Las Vegas for Christmas. And she's all done and goes, but in the movie, it's very much, oh, I'm just so wrong. I had a moment of moral weakness. Oh, I guess I really am just as terrible as Amanda Farrow, who we're introduced to, like, pleading with her married lover on the phone, too. And this is the moment she decides she's not going to be Amanda Farrow. And it is heavily implied she'll take off her hat and stop being such a bitch around the office. So it really has this feel like somebody tried really hard to neuter every single one of the book characters and make them like much more pathetic than they actually are. And I want to emphasize that Rhona Jaffe's book is pitiless and unsparing with like sexism. It's baked into everything. Like, she doesn't come out and say it, but she just starkly reports on the realities of these characters' lives. And the movie is completely different, where it's like, women, they get these silly notions to work. It almost never works out.
I want to see the sequel, which is a buddy picture between Hope Lang and Joan Crawford running the company.
Yes.
I mean, could you imagine? Just like, they're killing it.
The movie is definitely saying sexism. It's everywhere, but it's saying it happily with a big smile on its face. It's like, sexism, it's everywhere. Isn't it great?
Oh, that silly Brian Ahern. Yeah. He's just a card,
oh, Shalimar, are you still sexually assaulting your coworkers? Yes. Oh, you scamp.
You know, in the commentary at the very end, I wonder, Jaffe, through the whole thing, is basically shitting on the movie.
Yes.
and because it's so different from the book. And at the end, she's like, oh, this, what a great Hollywood ending. The nice girl ends up with the drunk.
I hope she was well paid for this movie.
I do, too. Yeah, I hope she was able to buy lovely homes on both coasts. She didn't have any interest in writing the screenplay, apparently.
She got $100,000 for the book. I don't know what she got for.
Okay. She didn't have any interest in writing the screenplay, apparently. She's like, yeah, you can have it. You can, you know, make a movie out of it. I'll take your money. But I don't want to be part of it. She probably was well aware that she wasn't going to be able to keep a lot of what she valued it in.
Two women wrote this movie, and I have to ask, did they do it at gunpoint?
I was surprised by how frank they were about abortion in this movie, because I was thinking it was only like, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years earlier that you couldn't say pregnant when Lucille Ball got pregnant, you know, on her TV show. And there was a film noir called Detective Story that came out, I think, around this time, that had an abortion subplot, and they were very, you know, very hinky about it. You couldn't, it wasn't very explicit, but this movie just really goes really boldly with being very clear what they're going to Maryland for, you know, Maryland, abortion central down.
Yeah, I think they say it's an operation. It's very clear what they're doing, but they don't say the word abortion. But also, I mean, that whole scene, the casual cruelty in this movie is just astonishing. No more so than the scene where Dexter comes by. She thinks April thinks she's going to get married. They get in the car together, and he says, "No, we're going get you an operation." She tries to bolt out of the. She bolts out of the car and loses the baby as a consequence. And he's just remorseless, and he's basically like, "I'll write a check," because that's the only he's a rich guy that she's met at this crazy picnic. And that's the casual cruelty. I also feel like there's in the scene where Eddie and Caroline have their final scene, and she finally gives him his walking papers. But first he says, "I talked to my father-in-law," at which point he says, "I'm going to have an office here. So I talked to my father-in-law about creating the circumstances by which you and I can be together, mistress person." I just like, it's astonishing. There are other examples, too. But just like, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of complaints I have about movies from earlier that absolutely tell you what to think and they tell you the wrong things. But this movie is so all over the place about, they're not saying, oh, women are being mistreated, nor are they saying men are right. No, again, women can't win. Mm-hmm. There's no way in which a woman can come out of this movie doing something that will cause her to have a happy life.
Whereas the worst thing that happens is that Louis Jordan feels mildly sad for a little bit before he goes back to banging probably yet another in a string of actresses.
Right.
All the men in this movie are garbage from beginning to end, and nothing bad happens to them. They are untouchable.
Yep. Yep. Well, to be fair, that actually is one of the notes that carries over from the book, which is consequences. It's what's for dinner if you're a lady. Whereas if you're a man, you get to go on doing your thing. And the book is considerably more matter of fact and angry about that. Whereas, like, this is why the movie is so weird with everything happens and nothing makes sense, is they glamorize so much of this. It looks beautiful. The actresses are beautiful. The costumes are divine. Like, Hope Lang doesn't put a single foot, like, whoever dressed Hope Lang did a fantastic job in every single scene. Like, she looks glorious.
I think at one point she's wearing Grace Kelly's dress from Rear Window.
Oh my God. It's just all.
She looks right for every stage of it, because she comes in as a secretary who is obviously above that station, but she's not yet an editor. And then when she becomes a reader and becomes an editor and she's going out at night, she's dressing entirely appropriately. She's very attractive.
What she wears to the wedding is so chic. And again, it's beautiful, but then you pay attention to what choices these women have and you're like, oh, wow, this is, again, things keep happening and nothing makes sense. And
speaking of not making sense, did you guys notice the book that Hope Lang notices and pulls out of the pile that Amanda rejected? And then Hope Lang is like, oh, this is actually good. If you look closely, it says it's a novel about a virgin and a sailor on a desert island.
Yes.
Oh, and speaking of cameos made by books, I was going to point this out. Apparently, I've talked about this before on the podcast, but apparently when Matthew Weiner was going to make Mad Men, he screened a bunch of movies from this era, The Apartment certainly being one of them. I didn't know specifically whether this one was one, but it has to have been, just by the look of it, and then also by this little detail that apparently there is an early episode of Mad Men where Don Draper is reading The Best of Everything.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. It's probably like in the first season or so. I just read that. I didn't go back to check it, but I love it.
Gathering intelligence on the enemy to use against them. How ex-military.
He's
going to
do a fine job of it. What else? Finally, I was going to give you a chance to talk about costuming if you wanted to. You've kind of done that, but is there anything else we need to say about the sort of clothing choices, and how do we feel about Joan's wardrobe?
Oh, about Joan Crawford's wardrobe?
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful. Oh my God, the woman rocked a statement necklace. I just kept stopping. I kept stopping to look at how beautiful her outfits were, because they had those really clean boxy lines where she very clearly echoes the architecture and color scheme of her office. And then she's got these fabulous necklaces that go with it. And like, whoever did the costuming for this read the book and had a clear understanding of that in a lot of ways.
And they were nominated for an Oscar, whoever it was.
You can also see how Diane Baker isn't dressed as well as Hope Lang. You can see the difference between their levels.
She never learns was wild. Like in the book, she learns and she picks up the visual vocabulary, and this is how she sweeps the Colorado man off his feet. And she develops some taste. But in the movie, she still dresses like somebody who should be in a production of Oklahoma and like never picks it up. And I sort of love that she's not tacky in the way that a lot of people in the secretarial pool are very plainly tacky. Like whoever was in charge of outfitting the secretarial pool clearly had fun, but April never channels chic. She channels fresh and wholesome, but like she never develops a visual vocabulary for New York, which is why the fact that she ends up marrying she's going to marry a New York doctor. Like that's just so weird to me. Because she's so clearly out of step in the New York of the movie.
But again, you can't. I think they would have had to develop her character a little more for that to sort of feel right. Because at this, she's the one note character. She's the naive. She's from Colorado the whole movie, and she gets taken by this New York guy, and then we don't perceive the guy she ends up with, this doctor, as a New York sophisticate, even though presumably if he's a doctor in New York City, he's got some education and background and whatever. But he just comes across as a regular guy with a bunch of pills.
Mm-hmm. So. A regular drug pusher, you know.
Yes.
Like Joan Crawford is the only character in this movie with an inner life.
And it's really interesting that she's portrayed as kind of kind of dried up and sad and old. And I think she was about 51 when this was made. And it's
51,
like,
53, something like that. Because there's still dispute that. About her actual year of birth, but she's early 50s, definitely.
Yeah, and as someone who may be in that approximate age range, I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, that can't have been fun for her. Now, Joan, you got to play this character as old and pathetically lonely, just really dried up and useless.
But she doesn't.
See, I would argue that she doesn't do that.
Yeah,
she doesn't do that at all. And she has sadness in her background, in her biography, in the mm-hmm. stories we learn about her faithless married lover and the fact that she's trying to go back to this old love and it turns out not to work. You know, those are stories about her life. But the way she plays it and the dignity that she shows when she's in the office, and even the way she berates people and is just completely, utterly unreasonable. she does it with a great deal of dignity.
Absolutely.
I love how unreasonable she is, because it's her way.
Yes.
It's her, with the caveat that hazing is wrong, please don't haze people. Like, you can tell this is how she filters out the brainless ninnies in the typing pool from people who might actually be worth paying attention to. Because the fact that she goes out of her way to continue interacting with Carolyn when Carolyn like just dishes it right back, you can tell that she's like, okay, you all pay attention to Greg can go get me cocktail napkins. And that is the extent of her usefulness. Like, I just don't.
Although I get the sense that she gave Greg the opportunity to meet David because she knew he was going to be at the party. And she does talk to Greg about her acting career and in sort of dismissive terms, but I also feel like she's intrigued by it. But I take your point. Yeah. And I like the scenes later on when she and Hope Lang interact, and it's clear that Joan Crawford is like, yeah, you're a fellow spirit, but I'm not seeing you as fundamentally competitive to me alone. You're somebody I'm interested in. And then, you know, at the end, they both end up working together because Hope Lang gets to go back, like, because Joan Crawford has left and then she's come back, and Hope Lang says, okay, you can have this job back because I'm not using it. And then Hope Lang ditches Eddie and she comes back and she gets, so everybody gets an office.
Do you think that she replaced Mike Rice, Hope Lang? Because there was some chatter online I saw about, you know, she walks out of the building and meets Mike because he's out there. And she's got this fancy office, and mm-hmm. she's got her hair up because she's a big executive. And there was some wondering, like, maybe she actually replaced him.
But there's no indication he got fired or anything. I mean, certainly being drunk is no obstacle to employment.
Obviously.
Nothing's an obstacle to employment if you're male in that office.
Exactly.
He's coming back from a 3-martini lunch.
100%. So he can have some more martinis at his desk.
He's probably seeing that, like, two of her and thinking, was she twins this whole time? Jackpot.
Oh, that's great.
Apparently Joan Crawford had a drunken scene, not playing drunk, and it got cut from the movie. I don't know why. I think it was too long, but supposedly there was kind of a real, you know, landmark scene with her having a drunken soliloquy. And I also heard from Rona Jaffe talking about the filming of the movie, that Joan was, her husband, you know, the Pepsi chairman, I think, was very, had just died, and she was very upset, and she went around the set, you know, very weepy and very upset, and carrying a glass of water that was actually vodka.
I'm sorry.
And there is one scene, I think I read that you can see the Pepsi logo on one of the soft drink machines.
She apparently insisted on in the secretarial
like
pool.
They're
supposed to be yes
yeah
yeah. There's supposed to be a Pepsi machine in the I think that would be actually a fascinating movie. Joan Crawford is the Pepsi years, like both when she's with him and then, because she becomes chairman of the company afterward, and she shills for Pepsi for several years. And it's just like, I would be fascinated to, I've read biographies of her, but I just would like to see like a little movie or a miniseries, Joan Crawford's Pepsi years.
What was her line? This ain't my first rodeo. This ain't my first time at the rodeo. That could be the title.
Yeah, there you go. Well, friends, thank you so much for talking with me about The Best of Everything. Lisa, thank you for suggesting that we talk about it. It was a trip. I might have seen this a long time ago, but I don't remember it. And you would think that this would be a movie I would remember. So I'm just going to assume that I haven't seen it before, because I did enjoy it a great deal. And to me, I really think Joan was a revelation. Not that she hasn't played parts like that in the past, but because her part is so circumscribed, she's not doesn't have really romantic interest that you see. I thought it was great. I loved it. So a lot of fun. Thank you all. The next episode of Lions, Harris, and Shields will be out next week. We will be talking about Gun Crazy, the film noir from 1951, directed by Joseph Lewis. If you would like to keep up with this show, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS, where you can subscribe. You can also find us on Twitter and Mastodon, because we like all the socials. You can find us at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Don't worry, all those links are on the website. Bye now.